It's an interesting new strategy to have the providers reach out to the relatives rather than having the patients tell their relatives themselves and having them come to us. Everything was able to be done with the participants from home.
Welcome to GenotypeCast, a new podcast from Gray Genetics. Genetics isn't always black and white. News stories related to genetics often raise more questions than they answer. On GenotypeCast, we bring you insight from genetic counselors. I'm your host, Eleanor Griffith, a certified genetic counselor and the founder of Gray Genetics, an independent telehealth genetic counseling and consulting service.
If we had government healthcare, it would make more sense for the healthcare providers to be reaching out to individuals or to treat it sort of like the way that the United States treats infectious diseases or sexually transmitted diseases, that it needs to be reported and that there are government individuals that participate and inform people who may have been exposed.
A study recently published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology tested the feasibility of a streamlined method of cascade testing using direct contact of family members by healthcare providers, telephone genetic counseling, and free or sponsored saliva-based genetic testing mailed to at-risk relatives' homes. Francesca Tubito is one of the authors of the study. Francesca Tubito is a certified genetic counselor and specializes in hereditary gastrointestinal cancer syndromes. She is dedicated to patient-centered care and has been with New York Presbyterian Hospital, Weill Cornell Medicine, for over 5 years. You know, I saw that you'd posted this on Twitter, and I was like, ooh, that looks interesting. We should talk about that. Especially, I mean, working in telehealth, I'm always kind of happy to see something suggesting how telehealth can be helpful. So, this article was published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, Prospective Feasibility Trial of a Novel Strategy of Facilitated Cascade Genetic Testing Using Telephone Counseling. I got through all of that in one breath. how did you end up, and you're one of the authors on this paper, how did you come to the idea of doing this study in the first place?
Well, Dr. Frey was really interested in doing a genetic study, and their group over there, they do most of their own genetic counseling, genetic testing, and it just was an idea that she had. She had initially done a smaller trial before this one to see if we can get it past the IRB, and then if patients would be willing to participate by giving their relatives contact information, and if people would respond. And so we tried that one and it worked. And so she wanted to look at it on a bigger scale to see what the results would be.
Yeah. And I mean, especially in hereditary cancer testing, like cascade testing is really the goal, but just seems like so often it doesn't happen. In just like the abstract, it said that historical studies suggest cascade testing uptake of 30% or less, which is kind of depressing.
Yeah. It is. And Dr. Frey and myself and most of the authors on the paper are actually very passionate about getting genetic testing to individuals. And telehealth seemed to work really well. It's an interesting new strategy to have the providers reach out to the relatives rather than the relatives or having the patients tell their relatives themselves and having them come to us. So we wanted to try that one out and see if we could increase uptake.
Yeah. And I think I remember from the paper, 100% of people agreed to be in the study, right? Even though a smaller number agreed to counseling and testing.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, that's pretty good uptake.
Yeah, well, it also included free testing for all of the relatives and having them not need to leave their home for the consultation and to receive the results. So the downside, the risks to the trial were pretty minimal and far between, that the patients all were happy to participate.
Right. You really removed like as many barriers as possible. Exactly. I found it interesting that in the reasons for declining testing, some of them, even though the testing was free, they still mentioned costs, just like, and I think it hypothesized just like lingering confusion about costs or just perception that somehow this was going to end up costing them money.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I thought at least one person said, like, I already know I have a BRCA mutation, which I found interesting because it just kind of reflects the failure of cascade testing.
That the proband, the patient herself didn't know that her relative had already been tested.
Yeah. It's like, oh, well, that might have been nice to know before she was diagnosed with cancer.
Exactly.
I know you weren't terribly surprised by the fact that this was overall pretty successful. There was a 6 6 months out, only 7 out of 66 of people who had completed testing had actually undergone any surveillance or had risk-reducing surgery. Did that part surprise you? That surprised me a little bit, but I know 6 months isn't really that much time.
Yeah, exactly. 6 months isn't so much time. So a lot of the recommendations that are associated with the mutations that the patients had are typically annual or even more spread out than that for surveillance. And when the patients were initially consented into the study, they were undergoing treatment. So they might have only been in the beginning of treatment. And, you know, when 6 months had come, they might have only just ended treatment. So it's not that strange that there weren't so many patients who had undergone any surveillance at 6 months time. It would be more interesting in another year's time.
Yeah. Are you planning to do any follow-up?
I do believe we are planning to have this study even further expanded than we did at this time.
Okay. And how, I mean, something like this, it's like so nice to have this kind of service where someone just calls you and says, don't worry about the cost, and sends you a kit. Is that, did you have like specific research funding, or is that something where Cornell just absorbed the cost? And of course, the cost of your time was, I'm guessing, covered by your salary, or how did you cover the cost of providing this level of service?
So the test kits and the cost of the tests themselves were sponsored by the laboratory. It was sponsored by Invitae. I'm not sure if we're supposed to say. I know that it is known that that was sponsored.
But yeah, it's totally fine to say.
Yeah, so the genetic test kits and the genetic testing itself was sponsored by the laboratory, which was Invitae. And Dr. Frey has a significant amount of research time allocated to herself. So she was able to use that time for phone calls and data analysis. We also had actually a genetic counseling graduate student have her thesis under the study. So she reached out to, she spent her time reaching out to many of the patients, sending out the questionnaires, sending out the kits, things like that. And we had several research coordinators too that are all authors on the paper that were able to allocate their time. So Cornell, yes, they pay our salaries, and no, we didn't block off clinic time to reach out to these relatives of our patients. Most of the time, only during research allocated time did we ourselves reach out to the patient. So we had research help that way.
Right. Do you see this like lessons from this, just in how effective it was, being practical for other centers to replicate, like maybe a community health center or I guess even when, I guess an unanswered question would be if the testing is not sponsored and you insert that question about cost, like what the uptake is too.
So I think that the uptake would remain the same, very high, much higher than our current method of cascade testing. Implementing it into a center, or you said a community center, it could work. It would just need the organization's support to be reaching out to individuals that are not yet patients, so might not yet be bringing funds into the facility, but potentially, since they are an at-risk relative and have a high chance that they may have their relative genetic mutation, that they could bring money in. So it would just be really having an organization that can see the benefit of this, both for patients and for the facility, but mostly for patients.
Right, right. But they're not, I could see like from a hospital perspective, there has to be some upside for the hospital to actually invest time and money in this.
Yes, and one of the tough things about implementing the way that we did this study exactly is that everything was able to be done with the participants from home. So they did not necessarily need to live within the area to come to our facility for treatment afterwards, whereas if the hospital were funding a position or somebody to do this type of strategy, that they would probably want the patients that are the relatives that are being reached out to live in the area to potentially at least have them come in for treatment if they did test positive. So that is one difference, I think, is in the research, it wasn't such an issue if the patients lived in a state across the country, but in clinical practice, it might be.
Yeah. What do you think about, like, is this something where, like as healthcare providers, we should have, or healthcare systems, we should have some duty to follow up with at-risk relatives, or do you think that onus should really remain on the patients to contact their relatives and then on those relatives to follow up?
I think it depends in what setting we're thinking about. So in the United States now, I think that it should, the responsibility should not be the providers to reach out to their patients' relatives who may be at risk, as the way that our system is set up, those individuals are not our patients and not the person that we're supposed to be providing our attention and our care to. While if you look at it from a different perspective, if we had government healthcare or a society like that, it would make more sense from that type of situation for the healthcare providers to be reaching out to individuals, or to treat it sort of like the way that the United States treats infectious diseases or sexually transmitted diseases, that it needs to be reported and that there are government individuals that participate and inform people who may have been exposed. So it sort of depends on what society we're discussing.
Yeah, yeah. And in this study, you were reaching out to everyone by phone. Did you consider trying to get like email addresses for patients or reaching out that way? Or is that something that you tried to run by the IRB? Just thinking maybe it'd be less effective, but definitely less time consuming if you're just, you know, emailing people, for instance.
I'm not sure why. I guess because telehealth is something that there's a lot of research going on with now to try and show if there are benefits, what they are, and how to use the type of counseling, versus email is sort of not a process or not a conversation or a consultation. It's sort of a message being sent versus having somebody there immediately to answer any questions. So if we were using email as a strategy versus telephone, I think it would be a difficult approach to take, because telemedicine isn't going that way yet. It's not texting or emailing. If anything, it's a video visit or a telephone visit, but it's not just solely text.
Right. Yeah. I was thinking if they got an email that then includes a link to schedule an appointment, but you know, you're always going to have certain patients who don't have email or who ignore that or confused or can't book an appointment online. So I'm sure you'd run into a lot of barriers anyway.
Right. And even with other much larger studies like All of Us, there are lots of ways in which individuals are made aware of that study, advertisements, not necessarily emails, but you know, not with direct contact with somebody, and there are phone numbers to call to participate, but you reach a person to discuss typically, or you schedule an appointment to reach a person to discuss. It's not just electronic.
Right. What else should I be asking you about this study, or what do you think that either genetic counselors or non-genetic counselors should be paying attention to?
I mean, we've been doing this study, this particular study took about a year, and the smaller one before that was another year before that. And the thing that's always going across my mind is obviously we're showing that there is significantly increased uptake of genetic testing for at-risk relatives using this strategy. And we've shown it twice and once more strongly than the first time. And we can do it again and do it larger and have even more strength behind it. But I'm really curious to see if there's a way that we can do some type of research project or advocacy or some type of something to see where the interest is, it may be in government or in public health, to see if there's a way that we can implement it. How can we actually implement it in the current clinical practice in the United States, because we don't have government healthcare really right now.
Right, right. And I mean, to your point from earlier, it seems like if you had people who happen to have at-risk relatives living in the same area, where it could be a benefit to the hospital system to have them become patients if they're high risk, there's like an economic argument, but so often in the US we're spread out.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for coming on the podcast to discuss this with me.
And thank you for having me.
And congratulations on the publication.
Thanks so much.
If you are a certified genetic counselor and would like to come on Genotypecast to talk about an issue related to genetics in the news, send an email to podcast@graygenetics.com.
The information contained in this podcast does not constitute medical advice and is also not a substitute for genetic counseling. Neither Gray Genetics nor any of its guests makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the statements or any information contained in this podcast. Evaluation of an individual's personal and family health history is a crucial part of genetic counseling and any recommendations.